Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. What's going to become of public education in Kentucky is in question. If you were with us last week, you heard from school district superintendents that it's getting harder and harder to recruit new, skilled teachers to the profession, teaching our children not just reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also how society works and the art of critical thinking. Teaching often seems under attack these days, but is anybody asking the consumers of that education for their points of view? Well, yes, they are. That's the mission of the Kentucky Student Voice Team. Young people, according to the mission statement on the KSVT website, co-creating more just democratic Kentucky schools and communities as research, policy, and advocacy partners. Eastern Standard's Corinne Boyer caught up with a group of KSVT students convened in Lexington.
Middle and high school students from Fayette, Clay, and Jefferson counties stand in a conference room inside the Kentucky Educational Television Building in Lexington. They've divided themselves into two groups. Students who agree that their race and ethnicity affects their education stand on one side of the room. Students who do not think their race affects their learning experience stand on the opposite side of the room. One student who agrees says,
ethnicity and my race definitely play a role in my upbringing and definitely have an impact with my parents and how I was taught and the values that I have.
A student in the other group says,
I have never had to think about my race. I've never really been put in a position where my race is what matters most.
Next, a student facilitator asks the room if they agree or disagree with this question.
I care about the political debates about how schools should address issues related to race and ethnicity in the classroom.
That's the sound of all the students walking to one side of the room because they all agree that issues related to race and ethnicity are important. Kentucky Student Voices Team, a nonprofit comprised of students, is hosting today's events. Their mission is to create more just schools and communities. During the 2021-22 school year, the Kentucky Student Voices Team conducted a survey of nearly 11,000 Kentucky students about race and ethnicity. They used the data and students' responses and published a report called Race to Learn.
Right now, we're going into the specific theme that we pulled from our Race to Learn study last year, which is racial and ethnic exclusion. So we're conducting roundtables that interview students on how that pertains to their identity in schools and like their experiences with it.
That's Minal Nazir, a junior at Kentucky Day School in Jefferson County. The Race to Learn report found that 46% of students say their school needs to do more to confront racism. It also found that 46% of students of color report that their racial or ethnic group is rarely or never represented in textbooks, posters, or in other materials in their classrooms. Additionally, 31% of students say they never have the opportunity to talk about their own experiences with race in class. Nazir and Rima Dutt are the co-leads for the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Research and Policy Team with the Kentucky Student Voices Team. Dutt, a junior at DuPont Manual High School in Jefferson County, says she learned about one significant topic thanks to a teacher who taught a lesson that wasn't in the curriculum.
I didn't learn about systemic racism until like my eighth grade. My language arts teacher took it out of the curriculum and taught us about it. And that's honestly like what got me inspired, because if I didn't know that, it would be so different.
Rachel Bellin is the managing partner at the Kentucky Student Voices team. Bellin says the data from the survey elevated student voices.
There were a number of bills last year that sought to censor classroom conversations about race and ethnicity and other controversial issues. And we'd like to think that by speaking to power and sharing some of the data that our team collected, that changed the conversation, and those bills did not pass last year.
On tables throughout the building, students share stories about what they learn in schools. I sit down with one group and ask if they learn about Black history outside of Black History Month. One student says,
for this month, we started learning about the Pan-African flag, but we did that for a week, and it's Black History Month, so, like, what are you doing? You know? And I mean, sometimes our English teacher, she talks about, like, Black stories. Like, we talked about Emmett Till, and that was cool. I didn't know who he was.
Students also talk about their teachers, sharing both good and bad stories. They also share stories about racist and insensitive remarks. It's hard to hear what these students, many of them in middle school, experience while at school. One student says after getting a haircut, her teacher grabbed her face and told her she looked really different. Another student at the same table shared what she experienced in her classroom after getting a new hairstyle.
It's like touching all of my hair. It was real weird to me.
After talking about their experiences related to race at school, students have a lot to say about how lawmakers are attempting to restrict what they learn. Student Aiden Velo.
How people make decisions for the classroom, it is kind of insidious because once you start doing it, it's difficult to stop. And I know a lot of people compare it to a slippery slope, which it can be in a lot of senses, because once you start controlling how children are taught in their education, you start controlling how adults act as well and what their knowledge base is. And I think the classroom should be this sacred place where learning shouldn't be restricted.
Eighth grader Abina Baidu says,
give students more ability to be able to speak about certain topics that adults may not be able to cover or that may have slipped from their personal ideas, and just let students have the ability to speak freely about these things.
The Kentucky Student Voices team works hard to advocate for better, more inclusive learning environments. I asked Rima Dutt if she has hope that things will change.
Sometimes it feels like it's hard to have hope when your school and your administration isn't doing anything about the issue. But if you realize that if nobody else is fighting for the issue, nothing's going to happen, mm-hmm. which I think what inspires Mel and I to continue like to do this work.
This legislative session, the Kentucky Student Voices team is working with two state lawmakers on two different bills. One would add non-voting student members to every school district in the state. Another would alter the current Kentucky Board of Education guidelines by allowing the student board member to vote on issues during KBE meetings. Minal Nazir says any student can join their efforts.
Being part of the team has been really like eye-opening for myself, because obviously like I've always tried to like advocate for myself and like my peers, but and I guess I never really realized how much like student representation matters and how our voices are just not represented adequately as much as they should be.
For Eastern Standard on WEKU, I'm Corinne Boyer.
You don't just one day walk into a classroom of eighth graders and try to teach them. Teachers had to be taught how to teach, and for decades, Kentucky had a system of university-based laboratory schools designed to allow young teachers to train in live classroom environments under the supervision of professionals. I went to one of those schools, Breckenridge and Moorhead. It was a K-12 educational experience for which I am forever indebted. Our student teachers always under the watchful eyes and the supervision of some truly amazing purveyors of knowledge and life lessons. Breck, as we called our school, is gone now. The building converted to other uses on the MSU campus. Model Laboratory School, located on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, is the only remaining lab school in the state of Kentucky. And it's the focus of the latest interview in our education series. Here's series co-host Gil Hunter.
John Williamson is superintendent of Model Lab School on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University and dean of K-12 programs. Mr. Williamson is a graduate of EKU and in his sixth year at Model. Mr. Williamson, thank you for talking with me today.
Gil, thank you for having me on your program. I'm excited to be able to share with audiences today about Model Lab School and a little bit about what we do at the university.
Absolutely. Well, Model is a lab school, as we said in the name there. Can you tell me what it means to be a lab school, maybe in theory and also in practice as it exists at Model?
Yeah, lab schools, Gil, were sort of founded in the early 1900s, and many people may be familiar with one of the most famous ones is University of Chicago Lab School, where John Dewey, the great educator and constructivist philosopher, you know, did his work. Lab schools were really founded alongside colleges of education or teachers' colleges to give university students opportunities to really practice the craft of teaching before they went into the classrooms. Since that time, lab schools have sort of evolved across the country to be centers of innovation and thought about best practices in education, really where they're able to try out new teaching methods and pedagogies, and university professors and researchers are able to have a place to experiment and sort of test methods and new teaching styles. So hopefully that's what, you know, we'll be able to do at Model Lab and be a sort of a beacon of light for not only the Commonwealth of Kentucky, but maybe the entire nation.
It's interesting you mentioned we'll be able to do, and we may get to some of that future projection on your part in a minute. Model's been on EKU's campus for over 100 years, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, a Model, like many lab schools, was founded, you know, alongside Eastern when it became a university. It was founded as part of the mission of the university as a teacher's college. Model was part of that university in 1906. And I think it's sort of the pinnacle of what EKU means for the region and maybe for the state, of being that destination where people come to become teachers and go out and learn the craft of teaching and educating children for the Commonwealth.
How does that relationship benefit Model itself? And then maybe how does it benefit EKU, which seems kind of obvious in the preparation of teachers? But what about on Model's end? How are students and maybe teachers as well benefited through that relationship with EKU?
Yeah, you know, I like to sort of think of it this way. You know, when as you mentioned earlier, I'm a graduate of the university, and I grew up in Pikeville and came to the university to become a teacher and actually did observations and practice teaching at Model Lab. And it was a great experience then when I became an educator and a school leader in Montgomery County and in Northern Kentucky. You know, we still look to Model as the place of where those great practices were happening. And so I think Model for a long time was a place where schools and districts looked to find out the greatest innovations. But the role of Model and the role of a lab school has sort of evolved a little bit, and all of the universities in Kentucky have sort of foregone the laboratory school experience. They don't have labs. EKU valued that the role of lab school and continued to fund it for a long time, and now it's funded through the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But the idea is now that we want to be a laboratory, a clinical site, a field experience across the college where students from psychology or occupational therapy or nursing actually come and work with students on campus. So we've expanded our role and try to be a place where more university students can come and get experiences as part of their undergraduate work or even in their graduate programs.
You mentioned just a minute ago that Model is now funded by the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And I want to kind of drill down into that a little bit, because many people across the state may have heard about Model following the 2022 legislative session, when there was a significant amount of funding awarded for constructing a new Model school building. Clearly that creates a great opportunity for Model. So what's the timeline for that project? And what, based on what you know today anyway, what are the big plans for that project?
Well, we're super excited about that. You know, we're in a building that was constructed in the late 1950s and early 60s. And as a former educator in a more traditional public school in Kentucky, I can tell you this facility is definitely one that needs renovation and brought up to the 21st century in terms of educational standards. And so we're excited to be able to do that. But in the same way that we want to be a model for educational practices and learning theory and teaching styles and that sort of thing, we also want to be a model for school facilities and the best practices in terms of delivering state-of-the-art pedagogy and the model for safe school design. And so we approached the legislature, and we're so grateful for the senators and representatives, especially our local ones, you know, Senator Carpenter and Representative Frazier and others, who really saw the need and saw the value that Model could bring to the Commonwealth. And they're going to help fund a replacement facility for Model Laboratory School. And as part of that, we want to be able to look at, you know, how schools are being constructed today, not only in Kentucky, but across the country and across the globe, to bring those practices right here and into our school design. So I think what you were leaning toward is, when are we going to start that project? and we're super excited to get it underway here, as you can imagine. We're right now in the process of selecting an architect. We'll spend about a year, 9 months or so in design and development, and then the build is about a 2-year process. So we're hoping to be in that facility, 3 years from today, opening up that school.
Yeah, great. So along those design elements, as you described there, you mentioned two things, both just a minute ago, and also in some other places where you've talked about this new model building. One of them is you keep referring to something like state-of-the-art school design or exemplary school design, and I hear the word example there at the core of that. You want the design of the new model to be part of the plans, I guess, that architects are putting together for you. In your vision, what might that look like, and where do you get those kinds of ideas?
Well, part of it is looking at what has worked well for years and years, but it's also looking to the future. Now students and teachers use much more technology, part of the learning process. There's much more engagement in deeper learning. And, if you have a conversation with Commissioner Glass, he's going to talk about ways to bring and cultivate students' own natural curiosity into learning. Mm-hmm. So it's more of student choice, drawing upon those ideas of John Dewey and constructivist learning, where students actually demonstrate what they learn through the creating, through performing, through designing. And so I think what you'll see is a learning environment and a facility that sort of cultivates the learning style, where we can have students be more entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. where we can ask students to actually create and engineer and make performances and demonstrations of their own. So they'll take what they know and they learn on a daily basis and then apply it in the real world. So I think you'll see lots more opportunities to bring in the community, to showcase student learning that's authentic, real, and and deep, where students are transferring their learning into authentic ways to improve the community and solve problems. And I think that's where many schools want to be, and definitely where we're going at Model Lab.
What you've described is liberating for students. It's freeing. You talked about inviting the community in. You want to promote that entrepreneurial spirit and kind of break down walls. At the same time, you say you want to be state of the art in school safety. So school safety, we know, is in the front of a lot of people's mind. I'm just wondering, how do you do those two things? How do you reconcile those two things, I guess, is the easiest way to ask that question.
Yeah, and school safety is of critical importance, and it's always on the front of mind of parents and certainly us as educators on a daily basis. With the tragedies that have happened in Sandy Hook or Columbine or Heath High School in Paducah or Uvalde, we learn from those tragedies, unfortunately, and we think about ways to make our schools safer, but at the same time promote learning. And so we will do school visits, and we will talk to educators and safety leaders in law enforcement in those communities and those contexts as we're designing this our new facility. But we are super fortunate in Kentucky, because when you start reading the literature about safe schools, not only in terms of facilities and physical plant, but we talk about philosophy and teacher and educator preparation, Kentucky is one of the leaders in school safety. In fact, the Kentucky Center for School Safety is housed at Eastern Kentucky University. We are so fortunate to have the chief state school safety marshal, Ben Wilcox, on our campus. And while he's a resource for all schools and districts throughout the Commonwealth, mm-hmm. We're fortunate to have him right in our back door. And he will be instrumental in advising and consulting in terms of helping us, think about ways to make the new model lab the model for school safety, where other architects, school leaders, law enforcement officials can come and see some of those safe practices. But the main thing is, it's not just, like I said, it's not just the facility. It's part of this, the spirit and embracing, you know, being aware of the school you're in.
Sure.
And our teachers are, they're really proud to and find really benefit in safe schools training and working with families and communities to make our schools safer.
I've been talking with John Williamson, superintendent of Model Lab School on the EKU campus in Richmond. Mr. Williamson, thank you for your time.
And thank you for having me, Gil.
This is Gil Hunter, interim dean of the College of Education and Applied Human Sciences at EKU for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
Gil Hunter is interim dean of education and applied human sciences at EKU. Coming up after the break, Tom Eblin talks with Lexington author Amelia Zachary about her account of overcoming a shattered spirit. Writer Stuart Waldner is with us on his book about giving up meat. And Jeff Slate once had a question for Tom Petty.
How do you become successful at doing this? And he said, without any hint of irony, do what you love and do nothing else.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. This is Tom Martin. Over the course of our recent six-part documentary series, Rise, about flooding in eastern Kentucky, one issue kept coming up time and again.
Our housing market is broken fundamentally.
We need more housing and we need it quick.
We deserve safe, decent, affordable housing just like everyone else.
This is going to be sort of what makes the difference in my view, whether this housing is ends up being rebuilt or not.
You can listen to the entire Rise series on demand online at weku-rise.org. More to come from the Eastern Standard team in the months ahead.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Following up on Rise, our series about all of the recent flooding and future prospects in eastern Kentucky, WEKU's John McGarry says there are new numbers around what it will cost to replace all the homes destroyed in the flood of July 22 and to repair those that were severely damaged.
The study by the Ohio River Valley Institute and Appalachian Citizens Law Center concludes it will cost $450 million to rebuild the nearly 9,000 homes in their present locations. Eric Dixon is a senior researcher with the Ohio River Valley Institute. He says another option carries a much higher price tag, but will eventually save money.
If you repair the damaged homes and replace the destroyed homes, and many of the majorly damaged homes in new locations on higher ground that are safer, then it's going to cost a lot more. It's going to cost about $950 million.
Dixon says repair and replacement assistance from FEMA only covers between 8 and 17% of the total rebuilding cost. For WEKU News, I'm John McGarry.
Tom Eblin's latest guest in our series on Kentucky writers is an author who brings to the page a life experience both terrifying and fascinating.
Lexington writer Amelia Zachary is the author of a powerful new book, Enough, a memoir of mistakes, mania, and motherhood, published by She Writes Press. Amelia grew up in Malaysia and has struggled with bipolar disease since she suffered a sexual assault while in college. Her memoir is an honest and gripping story of how she overcame that disease through love, treatment, and finding courage and knowledge within herself and her family. After living in Japan and Canada, she and her husband Daniel moved to Lexington, where they are raising two young daughters. Zachary is a gifted writer, and her memoir has a lot of wisdom and inspiration to offer people who are struggling with mental illness, either personally or with a family member or friend. She writes a blog about these issues at her website, AmeliaZachary.com. Amelia, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, tell us a little about your story.
So Enough is first and foremost a story of hope. It's a book to better understand the realities of PTSD and bipolar disorder. I take readers on a journey of heartbreak and self-destruction that I encountered in my younger days. And then through a path that I found myself on, I found myself on this path towards peace and facing the unknown.
Well, I can only imagine how hard this book was for you to write. How did you find the courage?
So I found my courage truly through my children. My two girls, I'm raising two beautiful daughters, and they're going to step into this world that I felt was not ready for their magnificence. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I wanted to be part of the conversations that change the stigma, change our outlook towards mental illness, towards sexual trauma, and I wanted a world that was better for my daughters. And so I guess, like, as any parent can would do, who want to make things better for their children, I found my power.
Did you find the process of writing to help you heal?
Absolutely. I wrote thinking that I had a story to tell. I wrote thinking that I had the answers, but I found myself processing my experience almost like a third-person view, and I was processing it in a way to make it comprehensible for the reader. In that process, I found myself finding different answers, finding new perspectives, and a way of understanding the experience that I had. And it was truly healing and therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of response have you received from readers?
I have received several responses, correspondence from people after they've read my book, saying they feel less alone, or they feel like they are seen, or that their experiences were validated. And that, for me, as a writer, is the utmost compliment, validation that I can get, that people get my book and feel connected to me.
Well, so much of your pain, as you described it, seemed to involve keeping secrets for so long. What have you learned about the power of secrets and how to come to grips with them?
The power of secrets. I think keeping secrets, really keeping things in a dark place, forced me into this state of being that I was not wholly experiencing my life. It was kind of watching myself survive, because I was trying to do things without confronting the truth in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, that was one of the things that I discovered, that I had been living in silence. I was also living in pain because of my secrets. And releasing them, telling the truth to someone else, I expressed the truth to my family and my children too. And I found a kind of release, a catharsis. Mm-hmm. That he was out, and now I was free to be who I was meant to be.
Do you recommend that for others who have secrets that continue to haunt them in this way?
I think it's a process, and it is about timing, and it is about where you are in healing. And I think I arrived at a place where I was ready, I was prepared to tell,
mm-hmm.
and it was a good outcome for me. So I would encourage others to take that step if they are ready, if they find themselves in a place where the healing is such that they are prepared to share the consequences, share the truth, and then meet the consequences, whatever they may be after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I found in your book was that you had a lot of really good advice for people who are struggling with mental illness, or either with themselves or family members or friends. And I'm wondering, if you could summarize some of that advice, what do you tell people in terms of to help them find healing, or to help a loved one find healing?
I don't like giving advice, to be honest. But speaking from experience,
right.
I think the thing that had helped me was to hold on to hope.
Mm-hmm.
That there was something that I had not understood or known, but I had given it time for it to present itself to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that healing is there for us for the taking. We have to make a choice for it, mm-hmm. make a choice to heal and to face our truth. And then I think it's holding on to that hope that things will get better.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've now officially become an American citizen. You write about that, and you seem to have found a really happy home in Lexington. What role do you think community plays in healing?
I think it's a large part of my healing. Finding a place that I felt safe, I felt secure, and I felt welcomed to be myself, whoever it is that I wanted to be, and a supportive community helped me grow, allowed me to thrive in who I was, who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that community is a big part of that security, sense of security.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you've found your voice and talent as a writer, do you have other books you plan to write?
Oh, the golden question. I guess I am working on something, and I hope it will come to fruition. I hope it does become a true manuscript, but I am working on something now.
Uh-huh. Well, good. Well, how long did it take you to write this book?
The whole book, probably about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'll share this with you, that I wrote the first draft in 2 months.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
I wrote it in the hypomanic episode.
Oh, wow.
I was feeling highly creative, and I was ready to spill my guts, and I did everything in a huge rush. But it all came out, and I had 160,000 words. And then I went to an editor, and we spent the next year editing it.
Right, yeah. Well, as they say, it's always all in the rewrite, but that's amazing. Yeah. Well, you've blogged now, and you also appear and speak at occasions. What's your main message to people based on your experience? What do you try to tell them to help themselves?
So I'm a huge advocate for normalizing mental health, that mental health is as important as physical health, and that we need to remove the stigma around mental illness. We need to remove the fear and shame and guilt that surrounds the topics of mental illness. I think that our conversations need to pivot towards healing and creating spaces for people to heal.
Well, thanks for being with us. And once again, this has been Amelia Zachary, the author of Enough, a memoir of mistakes, mania, and motherhood, published by She Writers Press. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. With us now on Eastern Standard is Stuart Waldner of Lexington, author of Escape the Matrix. It's a book about moving from animal-based to plant-based food. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Stuart.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I just touched so briefly on what Escape the Matrix is about, but tell us more.
Well, I'm using the world in the Matrix movies as a metaphor for our world. So in the Matrix movies, artificial intelligence has taken over the planet and is using humans as an energy source. And I say our world is similar because human beings, you know, we've taken over this planet. There's 8 billion people on the planet today. And we're using farmed animals as our energy source. And so I say that we're living inside the Matrix. And I know when Neo escaped the pod in the Matrix movie and looked out and saw a sea of those pods with human beings in it, you know, that was a really powerful image. And for me, what it conjured was, you know, these factory farms where we have all these animals that we're using as our energy source. So to me, I feel like, you know, we are living in the Matrix.
Is your book based on scientific research?
Yes. I've been doing this for 38 years. I gave up eating meat in 1985 at the age of 23, and I've been plant-based for 17 of those years. So the book has some information anecdotally from my own lived experience, but at the core of my book is the most current scientific evidence that supports why it's so powerful and beneficial to move away from animal-based foods into plant-based foods. So it's a very scientific book, but it's an easy read.
You point out that the belief that animal-based foods are a necessary part of our diet underscored, and I think that's something we've heard for most of our lives. But that is a deeply conditioned, widespread lie that benefits big business at the expense of the individuals and the planet's health. If you could expand on that a little bit.
I think, you know, the default thoughts we have in our head are not our own. They are thoughts that were put there by society and by our family. And so unless we examine our thoughts about anything really, but about food, you know, we're operating by this default thinking that we were indoctrinated into from a very, very early age. We're constantly being bombarded with all these advertisements saying that, you know, we need these foods. In fact, Americans today are eating 58 pounds more meat than we did in 1960, and we're eating 30 pounds more cheese than we did in 1970. So I don't think we were being meat or cheese deprived back in the 60s and 70s, but we're consuming more and more and more because of all the messages and the bombardment of advertisements that happens to us throughout the course of our life. And, you know, we assume that eating animal-based foods is natural and necessary, whereas the science I have in my book that I show says that it's the opposite. You know, we don't need these products. In fact, we would be better off without them. And that's what I found in my own life, too.
Well, I think that many of us are under the impression that animal-based foods are providing nutrients that can't be found anywhere else. Are you suggesting cutting out meat altogether or practicing more moderation in our meat consumption?
Well, I think it's up to the individual. I'm all about presenting the science, you know, and I want to help people make informed decisions. And I think the science in my book will help people make better decisions, you know, starting with the food on the plates and choices that they make in the grocery aisle. And, you know, it may be small at first. Maybe try, you know, incorporating more plant-based meals into your diet. Any kind of reduction in the consumption of animal-based foods will be better for you, better for the planet, and, of course, better for the animals.
I think you said it's been 17 years, right, since you made the switch?
Since I became completely plant-based, I've been plant-based 17 of the last 38 years. I gave up eating meat 38 years ago in 1985, and I've been plant-based consecutively for the last 15 years.
What sorts of changes did you notice, or were they noticeable over time?
Well, you know, I started so long ago. When I was 23, I was in pretty good health at the time. In fact, you know, I made this decision to give up animal-based foods because of my health. And, you know, Kentucky has, unfortunately, a lot of unhealthy people. You know, in 2021, Kentucky ranked 48th in healthy behaviors and 47th in health outcomes. And there's only one other state that has more people with multiple chronic health conditions than Kentucky. So I grew up around people who were, you know, basically suffering from these chronic conditions like diabetes, obesity, heart disease. And I made a decision at a young age to escape the matrix so that I could avoid, you know, coming down with one of these chronic conditions. You know, I grew up thinking that, you know, this was inevitable. We were all going to get sick and we'd all have to deal as best we could with pills, shots, and surgeries. But what I discovered, unfortunately, at an early age, that, you know, I didn't have to become a statistic. I could make a lifestyle change that would offer me protection from all the common illnesses that kills so many Americans. And, you know, I have avoided all of those chronic conditions. I'm 61 years old today, and I'm on zero medications. I'm in great health. And it's reminds me of what Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I think that, you know, my giving up animal-based foods was the ounce of prevention that meant I didn't need a cure. And the science of my book says that, you know, we can avoid, regulate, or reverse so many of the chronic health conditions simply by becoming plant-based.
You know, it's kind of ironic that you and I are talking about this in the largest cattle market east of the Mississippi River.
I know.
Have you gotten pushback from the beef industry or from the meat industry?
No, I haven't yet. But, you know, it is a part of the culture here in Kentucky. You drive around and you see cattle in fields, and, you know, you get this idea of it being very pastoral and this bucolic imagery of this great farm life. And, you know, that's what we see, but we don't see the harm to the environment that's happening by those cows being on the land. We don't see the harm that eating them does inside our bodies that leads to heart disease and cancer and stroke and Alzheimer's disease and diabetes, all these conditions that so many people are suffering from. So many of these things can be avoided through lifestyle. You know, people are adverse to making changes, and I understand that, but, you know, you can make them slowly and gradually. And any small changes you can make will be of help and be of benefit.
Well, where can your book be found, Stuart?
Well, my book is available on Amazon.
All right. That's Stuart Waldner in Lexington. He's author of Escape the Matrix. And we thank you so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, running down a dream that never would come to me. Working on a mystery. Going wherever it leads. Running down a dream.
So Jeff Slate is a New York City-based songwriter and journalist who, since 2013, has been contributing articles about music and culture to Esquire. He is the co-author of The Authorized Roy Orbison, and Jeff contributed liner notes to the 50th anniversary reissue of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, as well as to albums by Small Faces, Sean Colvin, and for the Stax Records 60th anniversary reissue series. Jeff Slate is Dwayne Lundy's guest for this latest episode in our series, Depth of Field.
Mr. Jeff Slate, one of New York's finest. Thank you for joining me.
Well, you're welcome.
I have a great deal of admiration for anybody that can turn their passion into their career. And you certainly have done that. Journalist, you've done some of the finest liner notes for some of the biggest artists, the Stones, the Beatles, Dylan, musician, songwriter. Grand plan, or did you just trip into it?
It tripped together over time. So I was, you know, I was a touring musician, and I was a musician for a very long time, and then had two young kids at home that I was raising by myself, which happened exactly at the same time the bottom fell out of the music industry. So sort of late 2000s. And so I couldn't go on the road because of the kids, but also I couldn't make money because streaming was starting to take things over and CD sales are flattening out. And, you know, it was just, everything happened at once, and I thought, okay, I need to find a way to make money that doesn't require me leaving the house for 11 months of the year. And I had always tinkered with writing. I'd interviewed a lot of artists when I was in high school and college, the Kinks and the Clash and Kiss, and you know, anybody who'd come to town, I'd interview them for the local paper. And so I thought, well, now that I'm, you know, at that point, I guess I was in my late 30s or 40s, I guess, and I had a pretty formidable Rolodex because I had been around in the industry for a bit. And then I got asked by the New York Times to interview Mark Lewisohn's Beatle biography. And then it turned out they couldn't run it for, there were a lot of reasons internally, and it had nothing to do with me. And so they said, well, look, you can take it wherever you want. And so I had a contact at Esquire, and they scooped it up right away. They were really into it because it had already been vetted. It was, you know, it was a pretty high quality piece even at that point. And the reaction was great. And they said, hey, who else do you have? And I was like, well, I don't have anybody, but let me see. So because I'd worked with Pete Townsend back in the 90s, I knew Zach Starkey, who was the drummer for The Who. And I said, hey, Zach, how do I get to your dad to interview him? His dad is Ringo Starr. Like a month later, it was with Ringo. And then after that, I did Elton and Jimmy Page. And then I could do kind of anything. You know, kind of it all started to fall into place. Meanwhile, you know, these things feed off each other. So, you know, I was becoming more visible doing that, but I was also becoming more visible in my music. I started putting out solo records. I had friends in the industry I could call on to play with, like, you know, Earl Slick and the guys from Bowie's band and the guys from Elephant's Memory and Wings and, you know, all this. And it, they were just constantly, you know, climbing this little tiny sea level ladder that I was on. But I got one piece of advice very early on in this story, which was I got to spend some time with Tom Petty, and I said to him, you know, how do you do this? You know, how do you become successful at doing this? And he said, you know, without any hint of irony, do what you love and do nothing else.
Yeah, there really is that moment where you just walk to the edge and have to take the leap if you're going to do it. Obviously, having a family and people to support gives you that extra incentive. I want to ask you, when you're working with so many high-profile people, a lot of which were, you know, are legends and potentially even heroes of yourself, how do you handle the nerve side of things as you're walking into these interviews and you're spending the time with these people?
You know, I'll tell you, there've only been a couple of occasions. Dylan, obviously, was one of them where it was like, okay, this is a really big deal. There was another time I was interviewing Willie Nelson, and in the middle of the interview, I went, damn, you're Willie Nelson. I mean, I couldn't believe, because he's like, he is this guy I grew up with. He's so much a part of my DNA. You know, the rest of the guys, not that I don't love their work, not that they aren't huge icons to me, but I've never been sort of impressed with stardom or fame or, you know, social status. But I think that's part of why people don't get good interviews with these guys. There's this legend. He's here now. How do I engage this guy in a conversation that is interesting, not just to me, but to him, you know? Because I feel like if that happens, whatever ends up on the printed page or in audio form is going to engage the listener or the reader.
I always find that the most nervous that you get when you're a writer or a producer or whatever it is that you have to return the piece of work back to the artist and get their assessment of where you're at. Add on to that, that you're turning it into Bob Dylan or the Rolling Stones or Jimi Hendrix's estates. Those can be tense times. It takes a certain amount of confidence when you finally do turn that over. How do you handle that?
When you're dealing with artists like the Hendrix Estate or the Beatles or the Stones or Bob Dylan's office, these are people who know the individuals they hire are under a certain amount of pressure and stress to deliver something. They're companies that are used to dealing with that, you know, the egos involved and, you know, the nervousness involved. So they, I feel like, and I never thought about this before until you asked the question, but I really feel like I've been treated better by those artists than anybody ever.
Yeah, I've almost found in the times that I've been in those situations that they understand, you know, and they want to get the best out of the people they've chosen to work with, and they've learned how to navigate.
But you're right. They're very comfortable in who they are. And so, you know, I think, but that's the nervousness thing. Well, if you don't knock it out of the park, they're going to tell you, or you're just never going to hear from them again.
Speaking of legends and heavy hitters, here's a song by Jeff that features the one and only Earl Slick from David Bowie's band on guitar and Duff McKagan on bass from Guns N' Roses. The song's called Heartbreak. I'm really interested in your thoughts on the concepts of reissues. There's so much of it. And obviously the classic rock people stretching from the Beatles and beyond have had an opportunity to do remasters. And sometimes it's been better because the technology we have now allows a little bit of a clear view of the work. There's some wonderful outtakes. You know, I'm a big Led Zeppelin fan. So those remasters and outtake versions of the albums were really interesting to me. And then there's this sort of doing it over and over again, and even to the point in which they're remixing these amazing classic albums. I know for me, like, there's the Time Out of Mind Bob Dylan album, which was a huge influence on me, one of my favorite albums. And that album has such an iconic sound. And now all of a sudden there's another mix of that album. Where do you stand on all this?
You know, there are some artists who I think it's worth doing, because anything that peels back the layers a little bit gives us more insight into what was going on. I'm kind of all for. I do think, however, not every artist is worthy of these reimaginings. With the Time Out of Mind, you know, I was able to hear it because my relationship with Dylan's office very early in the process. It gave me new insight into it. You know, it's sort of it's a singer-songwriter record as opposed to maybe a swampy blues record or a mood record. Just a week ago, I went back and I put on the original record and I was transported. Like, it's a whole, oh my God, this is what first grabbed me. This is the journey that I first took that wouldn't exist if this new version were the original.
Yeah, I guess that gives you a whole different point of view when you've been able to sort of look at it through a different lens, and probably brings even a greater appreciation to the original draft. Should be very interesting over the course of the next 20, 25 years as, unfortunately, these artists pass and those catalogs are administered by the labels and by the families. And I hope that they're curated with the intent that the artist originally had put into the work. New York City, you've been there a very long time. The pace of the city is my favorite part of it. I feel like I get a lot done there. There's an energy that it has. How much of that informs you, or does it inform your work?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, it's a John Lennon thing. It's like I've been everywhere else in the world, but New York City is my home. You know, and I knew at a very early age, my sister and my brother-in-law lived here. They were both in the arts. I would visit them at a very young age. They took me to the Clash and they took me to jazz shows. And it shaped my worldview that, not like, oh, anything's possible, but or I could do anything, but not to be afraid of experiencing new and different things that maybe the guy next to you doesn't connect with at all.
I've asked this question quite a few times to the people that I've been privileged enough to interview, in particular artists and even taking a step further, writers. Organization, templates, systems, so on and so forth, seem to exist with all of us and have some parameters and sort of can, you know, inspire and keep the work focused. What does a normal, productive, solid, good day look like for you scheduling wise?
You know, I'm still operating on the old kind of 80s, 90s model of creation. I don't do anything before 3 p.m. I would rather do something the night before and turn it into the person, if they need it at 9 a.m., you know, or noon or whatever it is. I would rather work till 3 a.m. and get it in. And, you know, I just find it really hard to shift into work mode until I'm like on the afternoon coffee.
And that's the great thing, I guess, about, you know, being an independent contractor and being able to set your own schedule and you know where your peak hours are and when you're most productive. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. Great admirer of your work and can't wait to see, hear, read all the things that you got coming ahead and spend more creative time together. Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne. I appreciate it, man. This is great.
Thank you for listening. This is Depth of Field with Dwayne Lundy on WEKU Eastern Standard.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, see our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Our Rise series about Eastern Kentucky flooding can be found on weku-rise.org, as well as on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you go for your podcast. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.